Blog Talk Radio.
My calculations are correct. When this baby hits 88 miles per hour, you're gonna see some serious sh-
What's up, everybody? It's an early edition of Punch Drunk Critics Live. We have our Best of 2012 show coming at you tomorrow at the regular time, Sunday at 7 o'clock. Today we'll be talking about the – we had to have an extra show, actually, because we have so many gosh darn reviews to cover that it's kind of crazy. One of the big ones we'll be covering is this movie right here. Or maybe it won't play. As usual, it's starting out perfectly for me. Let's try it again.
Can hold my body down. There ain't no grace can hold my body down.
Good cold evening, gentlemen. Amongst your inventory, I've been led to believe it's a specimen I'm keen to acquire.
When I hear the trumpet sound,
what's your name?
I'm on a ride right out of the ground.
Django. Then you're exactly the one I'm looking for.
Hey, stop talking to him.
Calm down. I'm simply a customer trying to conduct a transaction.
Last chance, fancy pants.
Oh, very well.
Do you know what a bounty hunter is?
You kill people, and they give you a reward.
Better they are, bigger the reward.
I need your help. I'm looking for the Brittle Brothers. However, I don't know what they look like. But you do.
Don't you?
They caught my wife, and they sold her, but I don't know who to.
That means we visit every plantation until we find them.
Once the final Brittle Brother lies dead in the dust, I agree to give you your freedom. And I'll take you to rescue your wife.
Where are we going?
Gentlemen, you had my curiosity, but now you have my attention.
How do you like the bounty on?
And that obviously was a trailer for Django Unchained.
That was awfully long.
It is. It was two minutes and a half long. I was trying to cut it down, and every time I went to cut it, they started talking about better part of the plot, better, and then I just liked that last riff.
The thing is, the music in that clip is amazing. If it doesn't get you hyped to see Django Unchained, I don't know what will. It's so exciting, and just listening to it, it made me actually. I think it may have actually raised my final score of the movie by half a point,
right,
just by listening to that again. But
yeah, Quentin Tarantino never ceases to amaze me on, like, because you look at the dude, he doesn't look like anybody that knows anything about funk music or how to incorporate it in anything, and he just, like, that's some of the most rock and funk blasted against a spaghetti western, and it just works. He's just so good at doing that weirded stuff that just is awesome. We'll be talking about Django Unchained.
Yeah, I think that's probably the main movie we'll be talking about, but there's a lot of stuff to talk about this week, and it's one of the reasons why we're doing this on a Saturday. But also because tomorrow we're going to be doing our kind of year, end of the year wrap up. We're going to be talking about our favorite movies, our favorite movies of the year, along with a couple other things that I tacked on there. I don't know if you got that email I sent earlier today. But we're going to be having our friend Nell Minow join us, the movie mom. Just by the name of the movie mom, you kind of know she doesn't really fit in with the way we look at things most of the time. And I think we'll be rating that episode clean rather than explicit like the rest of them are. But she'll be joining us, and we'll figure out, we'll find one other person to join us, I think, between now and then. But there's so much to talk about tomorrow, and there's so much to talk about today that we had to split this up. And I think we kind of have to start the show off with Django Unchained, I think. Even though we've got Les Miserables also to talk about, and we're probably going to get into some decent discussion on that as well. Also, Judd Apatow's This Is 40, and Parental Guidance, which I think just needs to be talked about, whether it's a movie worthy of being talked about is another issue, but it will talk about it anyway.
I think we answered that question right there.
Yeah, we've already answered it. But anybody who's listening to us now probably already knows my opinion of this thing and probably knows our overall opinion of that movie. So, but we got to start off with Django Unchained. I've had more discussion on Django Unchained than I think any other movie I've talked about this year. And that includes... That includes The Dark Knight Rises. That includes movies like that, The Avengers. Ironically, the two biggest movies that I've talked about the most this year have been African-American-centric movies, Red Hook Summer and Django Unchained, both of which in some capacity have to deal with Spike Lee. Spike Lee, of course, did Red Hook Summer, mm-hmm. A movie that I thought was crap, utter crap. And Django Unchained, a movie that Spike Lee has now famously said he would never see because slavery was a Holocaust and he doesn't want to offend his ancestors and all that crap. Let me just say, I respect Spike Lee tremendously. Mm. I love his movies. I love almost everything he does. Even the things that most people don't particularly care for from him, I like. Spike Lee is as wrong on this issue with Django Unchained as anybody can be wrong on something. And it's not that he's not welcome to his opinion. Of course he is. Everybody's welcome to their opinion. I don't subscribe to the idea that everybody's opinion has merit. Mm-hmm. I would say that high on that list of people whose opinions don't have merit are those who don't bother to investigate that which they are judging. And that is Spike Lee in a nutshell here, because he said he won't see the movie at all. So in my opinion, he has no right to comment on it. You just shut the fuck up.
Because obviously, you would have a better perspective on this than me, and it's kind of the reason I think Spike Lee has a problem with it is something I've always wondered how Quentin Tarantino got away with. You know, the language he uses. I don't want to say it's very real, but you know, for the time period, certainly it's real. He's a funny looking white dude from Austin, Texas, who's, you know, writing these scripts and doing all this stuff that has such, horrible language in it at times, dropping N-bombs left and right and all this stuff. Do you think that with Spike Lee it's has something to do with the fact that Quentin Tarantino is, you know, a funny white dude?
Yes, I absolutely think that's the case. And I wrote about this in my review only a little bit, because I didn't want to dive too deep into it.
Right.
But the thing with me and these critics, and there are a lot of them, Spike Lee's not the only one. I've had a lot of conversations with African-American critics about this these past couple weeks. If Quentin Tarantino had, let's say, left out the N-word in this movie, or had maybe only used it once or twice during the movie, people like Spike Lee and all these other critics would have been arguing from the opposite end of the argument. Oh my God, he's not showing exactly how these things used to be. He's not really capturing the feel of the time period, how terrible these slave owners were. He's not really capturing that. They'd be arguing the opposite end of the argument.
Yeah,
and that's what I hate about it. It's a can't win for losing situation here for Quentin Tarantino. But you brought up something in your comment that you said that how he's gotten away with being able to use the word so freely in pretty much all of his movies. I don't think you hear it in Kill Bill, but in Inglourious Basterds, really maybe you do once or twice. But for the most part, he uses that word a lot in his movies. And I think people have to realize where Tarantino's coming from. He's not trying to be black like some people have speculated. His movies are very heavily influenced by the blaxploitation movement of the 1960s and 70s.
Right.
Where that word was used quite freely by us, by African-American filmmakers, by white filmmakers, by everybody who was hip deep in that genre. Mm. And so he writes like he's coming from that time period. And I've come to accept it. I don't like the word. I don't like it when we use it. I don't like it when anybody uses it for obvious reasons. but I understand the context of it. And in this movie in particular, it should be there. We can argue about whether or not it needs to be there 70 or 100 times like it is in this movie, but it should be there a lot. Mm. So it didn't bother me. I mean, it didn't feel out of place, and I didn't feel like he was doing it just to show that he can do it, which is what I think a lot of people are trying to pin on him. I think that's a bogus argument that people are trying to come up with.
Yeah, well, I mean, the thing I always thought about, it, and you can just look at his actors that always come back for his roles. I mean, if what he was saying came out of a place of hate, and even I was like, you know, it makes everybody feel uncomfortable to hear that happening over and over again in a film. But, you know, sometimes it is, I don't want to say necessary, but it does, you know, it fit the time for what they're talking about. And I think
this is not supposed to be a movie that's light and cuddly. It's supposed to be uncomfortable. You're supposed to be as uncomfortable with the use of that word as you're supposed to be uncomfortable with the treatment that the black people are getting in the movie. You're supposed to be uncomfortable with all of that, the entire package. So if you're feeling uncomfortable, that's exactly what you're supposed to feel.
No, exactly. And, I mean, like, guys like Samuel L. Jackson wouldn't come back time and again if they thought he was, you know, a hateful person or even just trying to get a rise out of people. You know, I think you can really tell that he comes from a place of not honesty, but not hatred or anything like that. Because he doesn't see the problem with saying it over. I mean, but I almost think it's a downplay to this movie that's what everybody's talking about, because there's so much to talk about with this film that, you know, going to the hot button right there, you know, as obvious as it is, you know, I since it's not his intention wasn't to spread racism or anything like that or bring it back or anything like that. You know,
and his intention isn't to cure racism either. Right. His intention is it's just Inglourious Basterds, people. It's a revisionist look on history. It's wish fulfillment. It's the ultimate bad guys getting their comeuppance. That's what it is. Mm-hmm. I mean, you had Hitler getting his just desserts in Inglourious Basterds, and now this is Quentin Tarantino taking aim at racists. Mm-hmm. I mean, and the people who oppressed blacks back during the Civil War era. That's all this is. If you want to add more to it than that, fine, go ahead. But I don't think that's Tarantino's intention.
Yeah, you know, it's funny that you mentioned Inglourious Basterds and how it's a revisionist take on history, and I think, you know, I think Tarantino's really hit his stride with what he started with Grindhouse, which is trying to recreate a certain genre or subgenre or time period of film, where obviously Grindhouse was the 70s and 80s exploitation movies you were talking about. Inglourious Basterds was like like the original Inglourious Basterds and The Dirty Dozen and all these other World War II films. And then this, I found it funny when people first said Spaghetti Western about it, but once I saw the movie, it really clicked home. Like, you know, it's obviously a different plot line than most Spaghetti Westerns, but, like, the feel is really – I think he's getting really well at copying – not copying, but paying tribute to the time frames in film that he wants to pay tribute with like he does in this movie. I think he's really doing a good job of it now.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think even though I have my issues with Django Unchained, I don't think we need to go through the plot of it, because I think people know what this movie's about already. Mm-hmm. If you don't, then you're probably not even listening to this show, to be honest. You probably know what Django Unchained's about. But yeah, I agree with you that I think this is one of the first movies he's done in a while that's about more than just mimicking a style. He's actually saying something a little bit different here, which I think is really, really refreshing to see from Tarantino. But I also agree with you that he's gotten really good at like you said, mimicking, but I would, paying homage to these sorts of styles. And I think he's been kind of honing in on that ever since Death Proof. I mean, I like Death Proof. I know a lot of people don't. That one was very much sort of that was kind of him testing the waters a little bit, I would say, or at least going whole hog on mimicking the blaxploitation movies, whereas he's been a little bit more subtle with Inglourious Basterds. And here he's kind of blending the style with the style of the old John Ford and Sergio Leone Westerns. And it makes for an interesting mix, having that dynamic thrown in there, especially seeing it through the eyes of an African-American, which we don't really get. Now, I would also say that I wish there had been more of a focus on Django. He doesn't really become a major factor until later on in the movie, which I think is a little is a little disappointing to me. Yeah, he's there the entire time. And he that opening scene in the snow where the hilarious Christoph Waltz rides in on his carriage, which I don't want to describe because I think it's one of the best sight gags in the movie. When he shows up there in this very moody and atmospheric snowy scene and frees Django in a violent moment, is one of the best in the movie. But Django is very much a side character, a supporting character up to that point. I mean, from that point on, up until maybe the last 20, 30 minutes.
Yeah.
And I think that's a little disappointing to me.
About Christoph Waltz, that was the one part. I mean, I've made my feelings toward him very obvious on this show. But, I'll be honest. I think he's the opposite. You know, you say, oh, I can take him in small doses. I think he's better played in larger doses. Like, I still think that he's kind of a one-trick pony with, his line delivery and things like that. But when you see him in the trailer, and like you guys heard at the beginning of the show, you know, that's, you know, him in the opening thing when he talks all properly and fast. It's kind of hard to describe. But, you know, when you watch it in a movie, it fits a lot better than in little spurts like a trailer. So he's almost better in large. I really thought he was going to be my biggest problem in the movie. And while I did still take a little bit of issue with him, I think it's much better than I was expecting him to be.
I like him a lot in this, actually. He carries a lot of the momentum of this movie. Like I said, Django is not as much of a factor until later on. So a lot of it is Christoph Waltz. And he's probably the most complex character in the entire movie. We know Django's purpose from the very beginning. And for the most part, white people in this movie, not depicted so well as you would expect for a movie like this. Mm. But Dr. King Schultz, which is his name, he's probably the most complex in that he's a guy who's obviously not a bad guy. Yeah, he's probably an abolitionist. I think he calls himself that at one point. He may or may not. But he's also not above holding Django's freedom over his head in order to get what he wants, which is to capture the Brittle brothers to collect their bounty. So he's also kind of in a gray area a little bit. So I think that makes him interesting to me. And I think that's one of the reasons why I was so fascinated by him more so than I was Django.
Well, and that's one of the things Tarantino does. You know, I always say Tarantino's overrated, I don't know that he's overrated. I just think he gets credit before he deserves credit sometimes. Like for this movie, people were raising him up as soon as they saw the trailers. Now he ended up deserving it, but you know, I think he just gets it a little early. But this is why Tarantino's so good. It's not his amazing visual style that comes in little cues. Like I've been talking about that shot against the cotton fields of the blood since the trailer first came out. You know, it's not just that. It's stuff like the fact that he knows how to make characters that aren't white or black. Not race wise, obviously, but you know, thought wise. You know, there's gray areas in everybody, and he can make somebody like Dr. King Schultz in this hold, you know, freedom over his head or do whatever kind of things in the gray area he's going to do. And that really, to me, makes it more real because, I mean, that's what somebody would do in that. You know, he's not doing what the slavers are doing, obviously, but he is doing what he's got to do to get his goal accomplished, which is what everybody – I mean, we talked in Lincoln. You were saying how you liked how they showed that Lincoln, you know, wasn't, you know, Mr. Nice Guy all the time. He was underhanded and did what he had to do to get it done. And I think that's one thing Tarantino does well here is every character has both sides to him.
Right. No, I would agree with that. And until we come to Leonardo DiCaprio, of course, and DiCaprio, but DiCaprio is like where Christoph Waltz was the driving force in maybe the first two chapters, because this movie is really kind of divided into three separate stories here a little bit. DiCaprio is the guy who really is the engine of the last chapter when he shows up as Calvin Candy. It is very dignified and dandified Francophile who apparently knows nothing about France, which is funny in and of itself. But to see DiCaprio in this sort of role where he's obviously hamming for the camera, and we don't usually get to see him do something like that. I had as much fun watching it as he clearly had playing it. It was a great enjoyment to me to watch him doing that.
Yeah, you really, I mean, that's another thing. I mean, I keep going back to Tarantino every single time. But another thing he seems to do very well is that's why he brings all these comebacks, you know, what he did with John Travolta in Pulp Fiction, what he did with so many stars that he brings back from the dead, basically, and puts them in, not that Leonardo DiCaprio isn't dead, but, you know, he can make his actors feel so comfortable in these otherwise uncomfortable situations that they can ham it up and not feel like they're, you know, giving a bad performance. And it really, you end up getting the best stuff out of that. Because somebody like DiCaprio, you know, he's almost become like a Sean Penn, where he's never not taking himself seriously. So it's really refreshing to see him in something where he can, you know, act over the top and act a little, you know, out there.
That's the interesting thing about the character, about the performance, really, is that even though he's clearly, you know, chewing up scenery, he's still DiCaprio, and he's still creating this real character, this real life character here. You know, there's nothing fake about him, even though he's obviously a phony.
Yeah.
There's obviously a phony. The performance isn't fake by DiCaprio. So it's very interesting to watch that. And I would also say, to an extent, the same extends to Samuel Jackson's character, who is another, I think probably more than anybody else, exemplifies Tarantino's theme of our perceptions of power in this movie. Because one of the things that's interesting to me is how Django is perceived, not just by the white people. We know how they perceive him, but by the other black people in the movie, the slaves who look at him as almost like he's better than them, but not quite. And then you had the white people who are kind of stuck. And there's this great scene in there with Don Johnson, who plays this another plantation owner. And Django comes riding up on his horse, and black people aren't supposed to be riding horses back then. And he's kind of taken aback at how he's supposed to treat Django. Does he treat him like a regular slave? No, he can't do that, because clearly he's not a regular slave. But he's not quite a white person either, so you can't quite treat him with that same respect. So
right.
He's struggling for about 5 minutes trying to figure out a way to treat him. And it was just, I mean, it just kind of showed, it's Tarantino really showing the absurdity of the time period, you know, the absurdity of that line of thinking back then. And he does it again with a great scene with the Ku Klux Klan, which I don't want to get into and spoil either. But those are the things to me that make this movie work. I mean, it's a revenge tale, but he does have some things to say. And yeah, he's making fun of evil by taking it to its comedic extent. It's kind of, it's almost like what they do in Blazing Saddles, but a little bit more serious.
Mm-hmm.
But that's the stuff to me that makes this movie work.
Yeah, well, you talked about like the absurdity of the time, and I thought that, you know, Samuel L. Jackson, especially, you know, the way they kind of, I, you know, obviously none of us were around back then, so I can't tell you if it was a caricature or not. But I'd imagine that was a little bit, you know, more of how something actually would have played out, like that. Just the worry of this man that he's already a slave. So, you know, things aren't shiny for him anyway. And, you know, the daily stresses are things like, how do you talk to, you know, it's like life or death, basically, how you going to talk to somebody. And, you know, it just, I, the way he puts it out there, he manages to walk a very fine line between absurdity and seriousness that makes movies like this that would otherwise be depressing at best entertaining. And without sacrificing a message or a story, and without sacrificing fun, he's able to get all that stuff in there.
Right.
But what do you think about, you know, Tarantino's famous for his run times of his films. That's something I'm hearing a lot of people talking about for this movie, too.
Yeah,
I'm surprised he doesn't go Peter Jackson at some point and start splitting these up. Because, like you said, three chapters could have been three movies if you put a little padding in between it.
Well, he split up Kill Bill into two movies. He probably could have split this. We did hear that he did do some significant editing on this movie, so probably a lot longer than this.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, they probably still could have done some more editing, because I did feel like it kind of sagged in the middle of the movie. I don't want to say chapter, but it kind of goes from scene to scene to scene, like vignette to vignette to vignette. And I don't feel like they all quite work. They don't all quite lend themselves to building up Django's story to me. They just didn't all quite connect for me. So I would say there probably was some more editing he could have done. But overall, you know, I didn't feel like the movie was too long. Like I wasn't looking at my watch or anything.
Right.
But he probably could have chopped down a few minutes.
Yeah. He definitely. There's plenty of movies out there. When you really think about, hey, this movie is almost 3 hours long, that you know your ass is starting to hurt sitting in the chair. But and you know it does have a slow time, people. But don't be daunted by the runtime. You should go out and see it anyway because I'd say 90% of it moves as fast as you need it to. The one other thing I wanted to ask you about this movie, the casting of Django himself, if anybody was following this from the beginning, I mean, we had, you know, Will Smith was in the lead to play it for a long time. Then we ended up with Jamie Foxx. Yep. Now, Jamie Foxx obviously has proved himself since Ray and maybe even before, you know, depending on what you're looking at. But every time I think of Jamie Foxx, I always think of, well, honestly, the first thing I think of is Living Color. You know, it's movies like Booty Call and Any Given Sunday, where he's Willie Steeman Beeman. You know, I always forget that he's got a lot of talent as an actor. I mean, do you think they ended up with the right choice for Django and Jamie Foxx?
I think he's a good choice. He's got the masculinity, the physicality needed for the role. He's properly intense. I think he's good, and he's funny when it calls for it. There are a couple of times where Django has to be really kind of dark and humorous as well, and I think he's good for that. I think he's better for this role than Will Smith would have been. I would have liked to have seen Will Smith try it, just to see him do something different. But you know, I like Jamie Foxx in the role. I think he's good. I think the casting overall was strong. My only disappointment for me was that there wasn't more for Kerry Washington to do in it as his wife, Broomhilda von Schaft, and that she is supposedly related to Shaft, the one we know in the 1970s. But yeah, I wish there was more for her to do in the movie. But otherwise, I love the casting quite a bit.
Yeah, I mean, Kerry Washington, man. I was actually just looking at her name as my next thing to talk about before you said that. And, I mean, I think the first time I remember seeing her was in Fantastic Four. But I don't think there is another actress that can look so gorgeous, regardless of how. I mean, she's not made up in this movie at all, and she's still a stunner.
She's gorgeous,
but she can act too, is a different thing.
Yeah, she's gorgeous, and she's wicked smart. If you ever listen to her talk, so she's good. You know, this movie does get awfully violent towards the end, as you would expect. I compared the violence in the final chapter of this movie to the crazy 88 scene in Kill Bill. If that was too much for you, then the ending of this movie will probably be too much for you also. But, you know, to me, I dug it. You know, it got a little repetitive after a while, but otherwise I found it to be a lot of fun.
Yeah, not too repetitive, though. That was a good thing. You know, I love little bits of the excessive, almost comedic violence that's in this movie, like when you shoot somebody and 16 pints of blood flies out of them. You know, that's another fine line you have to walk. I mean, you think about it, Tarantino's a damn tightrope walker with all the things he does here. Because if you do too much of it, it really becomes comedic and not it doesn't have the impact it's supposed to have. And he almost gets there. It's like if anybody remembers the end of Inglourious Basterds where they're taking out Hitler. It's like that amped up to 11 with every person that's there. But I thought he did the perfect amount of everything, maybe a little bit too much in some parts, but not enough to take me out of it. So I'm actually really, really surprised how much I like this movie. Even Jamie Foxx's Austin Powers getup was awesome.
Ultimately, I gave this a 3.5 out of 5. I do think it's probably the movie to see this. If you still haven't gone out to the movies for the holiday season, this is probably the movie to go check out. So, 3.5 out of 5 for me for Django Unchained. What'd you give it?
I give it a 4 out of 5. I was skeptical of a lot of people saying it was Tarantino's best. I don't think it was his best still, but you know, he's got 2 or 3 movies that are all between 4 and 4.5 out of 5 for me, and this is one of them. So.
Yeah, I still put the Kill Bills as my 2 favorites. I'm not the Tarantino fan that a lot of other people are. I like him just fine. I'm one of the few that does not like Reservoir Dogs all that much. I like Pulp Fiction, but don't love it. I don't like Jackie Brown that much. But I absolutely adore both Kill Bill movies. I think they're about as attuned to me as movies can be. I like Inglourious Basterds, don't love it. And this one I like a lot, don't really love it, but I like it a lot. So, you know, he's a director I like, but don't love. So, you know.
Yeah.
All right. So that's Django Unchained, and that was a good long discussion, I think. We talked about that for almost 25 minutes.
Yeah. So, but in relation to if it's runtime to everybody else's runtime, it's not really that long.
Exactly. All right, so we have to talk about Les Miserables next. Les Miserables, and I really don't want to get into the plot of Les Miserables, so I don't know if you want to do it or if you just want to skim it.
Yeah,
it's one of those movies that I figure everybody knows the plot to also.
Yeah, I didn't actually know the plot. I didn't know much about it. I'd always seen the poster. I'd heard, obviously, about the play 100 times. But basically, it's the story of Les Miserables, by the way, everybody, in case you couldn't tell, is the miserable in French. So that gives you an idea of what we're talking about here. It's about...
It gives you the idea of how I felt by the end of it. Oops, that spoiled my review already. Oh, well.
It's basically the story of a guy named Jean Valjean, who and it follows his entire life with a policeman played by Russell Crowe named Javert, who follows him down through everything. And along the way, he breaks out of a prison camp or whatever they kept French prisoners in, and he tries to start his life again, and Javert is hunting him down the whole time. He comes across Anne Hathaway, and something happens there, and everything's miserable, and then he adopts her daughter, and everything's miserable, and we get all through, and everything's miserable.
He discovers Anne Hathaway, and she gets her hair cut and her teeth pulled.
Yes.
And that's what happens to her.
Yeah, all while singing a song, which is awesome. But I can tell that you didn't like it too much, but honestly,
Tell me you were one of those guys who was in there crying. Please tell me you were not one of those guys.
I mean, crying is like plural. I mean, I might have had a tear at some point.
Oh my God.
But I mean, I am the exception to the rule. I'm a straight married man that likes musical theater sometimes. Now, I don't like the flashy, 42nd Street type glittery stuff, but you know, this is really, I mean, there's a lot of really power, the sound score, whatever you call it for musical, all the songs are very powerful. There's really great performance. I mean, I don't know what I saw that everybody else didn't, but I thought Russell Crowe was amazing in it too. Hugh Jackman really pulled it up. I mean, this is his wheelhouse, though. People forget Hugh Jackman loves musical theater before anything else, before he Wolverine. But it was very well acted, very well done, great singing. The only thing is I see a lot of people not liking it because they saw it. The same as reading the book first. They saw it in the theater first. And the thing about these powerful songs you hear is hearing them live is a way different experience than hearing them in a movie, no matter how good the movie is. So I can understand why people aren't liking it as much that have already seen the play. But I think it's certainly – if you saw the trailer, if you like musicals at all or even just powerful stories about French where people are sad the whole time, I don't think there's a way you should miss this movie.
Well, I'll say that people who like Les Miserables will probably like the movie just fine. Mm-hmm. I'm not one of those people. I've never really liked Les Miserables ever. Didn't like it. I don't like Victor Hugo's book. I've never seen the stage play, but I imagine I wouldn't like it very much. Mm-hmm. And I don't like this movie at all. I'm not someone who's against musicals, and some have tried to peg that label on me, Tim Gordon. I'm not one of those people who hates musicals. I love a lot of musicals, actually. This is just not one of them. I don't like the kinds of musicals that are like this, the kind where every single word of dialogue is sung. I don't like it. It takes me right out of the moment. And with the exception of a very few times, everything is sung in this movie. And it makes for an awkward shift when Hugh Jackman is the one who does this the most, where he has to switch from singing to regular dialogue with somebody. It mm-hmm. always sounds horrible. And Jackman, I don't know why he does this, but he still does the kind of the vocal flourishes when he's talking as if he's still singing. And I'm like, what the hell is that supposed to be?
Okay, yeah, I don't know what that is.
I don't know what that is. And stuff like that takes me right out of it. But I feel like Les Miserables is one of those movies that if you're not invested in the songs, because all the emotion in this film is packed into the words and the music. That's where it all is. If you're not into those songs, then you're not into this movie. And I feel like that's also why so many people, when they talk about why this movie is great to them, they only reference Anne Hathaway. I mean, they talk about Anne Hathaway's scene, and her scene is remarkable. She deserves to be nominated for Best Supporting Actress for that one scene alone. She only gets a couple of scenes, really. But that scene where she sings "I Dreamed a Dream" is simply fantastic. And if you're going to cry at a scene, that's probably the one where you're going to do it. She's fantastic there. And Tom Hooper's plan, his big idea for this movie, to record the singing live on set rather than using a studio. It's a double-edged sword. It works perfectly in capturing the urgency and kind of the immediacy of the emotions in Hathaway's scene. But it also takes me out of it during, like, Russell Crowe's and Hugh Jackman scenes, where I don't feel like they're quite up to snuff singing material like this. Yeah, they're great. Russell Crowe's great in his Australian rock band. His voice is great for that. Is it quite up to the standard of Les Miserables? No. And it sounds awkward when he's trying to sing it live. It just doesn't sound that good to me. And Jackman is okay. He's okay. But I didn't feel like he was anything spectacular either. Practically everybody else was better than them. Samantha Barks, you know, she's done Les Miserables on stage before. She's good. Eddie Redmayne is pretty good. But it's Crowe and Jackman who do the most. And they didn't work for me.
Yeah, you know, honestly, I have seen a lot of musical theater, but it has been a while since I've seen any, so maybe my taste isn't up to snuff with what the actors should be singing like. I thought Crowe and Jackman were awesome, and what I saw them in. I do see what you're saying in the talking to singing parts, and when they sing the entire time, like it's kind of a. I'm not sure where to go with it on this one because, on one hand, I thought the songs kept me enraptured enough where I didn't notice, or if I did, I just dismissed it quick enough when something wasn't very smooth from the transition. But there were, now that I think about it, there was one or two times in the movie that I almost wanted to snicker a bit because they're singing like, "Where did I leave the mill?" You know, something like,
something
doesn't really need to be sung. But I thought all in all, I thought Jackman and Crowe did a great. Maybe it's also because I didn't know Crowe could sing. and that being said, I think he's pretty. Amanda Seyfried, I never seen Mamma Mia.
She's horrible. She's horrible in this movie, by the way.
You think so?
She's terrible. Yeah, she's not good. She's fine in Mamma Mia. But you know, I've had this conversation about Mamma Mia a lot, just because of this movie, because a lot of people have been like, well, Russell Crowe wasn't as bad as Pierce Brosnan was in Mamma Mia. And I'm like, well, the difference is the reason why we didn't care that Pierce Brosnan was bad in Mamma Mia is because it was Mamma Mia.
And because
he was having so much damn fun in that movie, because it's a fun movie, that you don't care that he sounds like crap. It doesn't matter. This movie's not that. This is a deadly serious movie. And when somebody's not good, it stands out like a sore thumb.
Yeah.
So it's not the same comparison. It's not the same comparison. But, you know, but Amanda Seyfried falls in that category as well. She was fine in Mamma Mia. She's not so fine here. Distracting to me, actually.
She's one of the ones I wouldn't put her distracting, but she is one of the ones that I would say wasn't up to snuff with what they were doing, especially when she's, you know, as far as the female leads go, she's up against Samantha Barks, who was amazing, I thought, and Anne Hathaway, who, you know, as little screen time as she had, was, you know, dominated the film with the little bit of screen time she had. So
you want to know who I really liked? I like Sacha Baron Cohen and Helena Bonham Carter. The Master of the House, Keeper of the Inn is one of my favorite songs. Anyway, I love that song.
Yeah, a lot of people do. That's like the favorite of this movie, believe it or not.
It's a great song. It's my favorite part of the movie because they're having a good time. I mean, it's Cohen and Carter and they're kind of getting a chance to just be jovial and be silly, and God, this movie needed that shit. It needed it bad. So every time they came on, I loved it. I mean, I was happy to see them both. But I also want to talk about Tom Hooper, who, you know, I was not one of those people who loved The King's Speech. I thought it was fine. I didn't think it was the best movie of the year that year. Tom Hooper needs to learn a different way to shoot. I think he just the way he shoots this movie, everything is just whirling around, and the camera can't stay still for a second. It's not appropriate for this movie. It's not appropriate for Les Miserables.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't work. He shoots it like he's got The King's Speech, and they're not the same.
Yeah,
they're not the same. I don't like.
I've said plenty of times how I don't have a good eye for direction. Like when a director does something silly, unless it's something like obvious, like a Michael Bay flyover, I don't really notice it. But you know, it almost seemed to me, I did notice his shooting style in this, and while it didn't really bother me that much, it did seem like he was trying extra hard to not shoot it like you would a stage musical, to make it look like it had, you know, like there were no sets, like it was in the world, and that there were. That there was more breadth to the domain of Les Miserables than what, you know, because I mean, obviously you would think everybody's only, I mean, there's been like four movie versions of it, so he could have just taken a cue from one of them, but, you know, it did seem like he was trying extra hard to make it look like it wasn't a stage play made for a movie.
Yeah. Ask me, he was trying extra hard to make an Oscar movie again. So I don't know. For me, Les Miserables, 2.5 out of 5. I know a lot of critics at the screening I was in were in tears. Those who have sperm in their bodies, those guys should turn in their man cards immediately. I understand the women, you know this movie's aimed, this movie's for them, but guys, I'm afraid not.
Oh, I'm keeping my man card, and I get emotional.
If there's a single tear that fell from your face during this movie, you need to check that joint in real soon, like before somebody else comes and claims it. But
well, I think that's all relative to how much you like the music. Because I mean, this movie is shut up. This movie is very, very dependent on how much you like the music. So if I was you, and you're thinking about going to see this, you know, I give it a 4 out of 5. But I loved the songs. I love the music in it. So, and Travis didn't like that, the songs music so much. So that kind of tells you where you can go. If I was you, I would go to YouTube and don't look up Keeper of the House or I Dreamed a Dream or whatever it was. Look up one of the other songs that's not an obvious go-to. And if you still like it, if you still feel enraptured by it, then you'll like the movie. If not,
go to our website. In fact, go to Punch Drunk Critics. We have some scenes from the movie on there. Just type in Les Miserables. That are not just the Anne Hathaway scene. There are other clips. In fact, we had the biggest number in the entire movie on the site as well. So go check that out. If that moves you, then maybe you want to go see this. If it doesn't, go see something else. There's so much out right now that you're not going to be hurting for options.
Right.
So,
it's really you have both. You have like this is the week with the most polar opposite guys' choice, girls' choice movies out there. Like if your girl makes you go see it, and you see Les Miserables, and then you want to get her back, take her to Django. You know, it's
there's no shortage of movies to go see. Django Unchained, this, what was the other movie? Did we talk about something else yet today? No, we didn't.
Yeah.
Rust and Bone is expanded into more theaters. That's the movie I tell you to go see. There's so much, including
I think
the movie
that, with Rusty Trombone, which is playing in very few theaters.
I thought Rusty Trombone was a porn.
It is. Playing in very few theaters.
That's what I thought. But another movie that's out right now that you could go see is a comedy, quote unquote, from Judd Apatow, and it's This Is 40. I believe this is his fourth film. I think this
Judd
is
Apatow?
His fourth film. Yeah, this is his fourth movie, correct?
Directing?
His fourth directed movie.
I feel like it's been a lot more than that, but I'm looking it up right now.
The 40-Year-Old Virgin, Knocked Up, Funny People in This. Yeah, this is his fourth film. And this one is a quasi spinoff of Knocked Up. There's no Jason Segel, not Jason Segel, there's no Seth Rogen, there's no Katherine Heigl. But it follows Paul Rudd and Leslie Mann's characters from that movie, the troubled couple from that movie. And they're still troubled, apparently. This is another movie where you probably already know the plot of the movie. Look, if Judd Apatow has problems in his marriage, we're going to know about it. You know why? Because he'll put it in a movie. That's what This Is 40 is. This Is 40 is basically Pete and Debbie from Knocked Up approaching their 40th year, and they're worried about growing old. They're worried about their marriage, keeping the spark alive, taking care of their two daughters, who are also Judd Apatow's real daughters. Judd Apatow and Leslie Mann's real daughters, I should say. They're also worried about their finances, their careers. His business is failing. Hers is apparently being robbed by somebody from the inside. They're worried about their fathers who are either mooching money from them or not there in their lives at all. There's so much going on in this movie. And I feel like this is a recurring issue for Judd Apatow at this point. He had a similar issue with Funny People, which is a movie that I thought was arguably one of the 10 best if we were only counting the first 30 minutes of the movie.
Yeah.
And then it just sort of died out.
Because I remember you not liking it like
yeah.
I didn't like it.
This is exactly the same for me. I would say the first hour of This Is 40 is brilliant, insightful, witty, and a lot like the movie Friends with Kids. It takes a different sort of look at growing older and staying in love. I thought it was very unique in that way. And then it just sort of falls flat. And it's like Apatow has so much he wants to say that he can't find enough humor to keep that stuff interesting. you know what I mean?
It's really funny. Not to interrupt you here, but the one thing that I've been saying ever since I saw this, and it's funny because Apatow kind of did a little precognition with Pete in the Knocked Up movie that this is a quasi sequel to, as you said. Because he describes this movie perfectly in a line from Knocked Up, which is when he tells Ben Stone, Seth Rogen's character, "Marriage is like a tense, unfunny version of Everybody Loves Raymond, only it doesn't last 22 minutes. It lasts forever, or in this case, 2 hours."
Right.
That is
the perfect summary of this movie, actually.
it's all I can think of a watch. Didn't he say something that describes – because it got to be places that it was funny, but then it didn't go where it needed to be. And then a lot of places went too far. Maybe there's a subset of people that still thinks it's hilarious to see Paul Rudd looking at his own butthole and asking his wife to come check it out.
There were so many
parts of this movie. Travis, correct me if I'm wrong here, if I saw something wrong, but there's so many moments where like Paul Rudd does his usual shtick, and then it's like they left a pause, like you would do for studio applause, and they left a pause for you to laugh, but nobody's
for
laughing. It's just like. And like that whole thing was so overdone. I really, really didn't like this movie that much. I did like how it ended though. I liked John Lithgow, his spread because
he's
the guy.
Interesting.
That,
he's interesting. Their fathers are an interesting subplot that should have been in a different movie. That's my problem with it. I love the Albert Brooks thing. He kind of plays his overly Jewish thing that he does a lot, but it's always funny when he does it. His father, he's a bit of a moocher. He's basically robbing his son blind, asking for money all the time.
$80,000 isn't really mooching.
And I like that because that's the perspective they bring is that the way we are parented affects our future relationships. It's an important element of the story here. That isn't given its proper due because there's just so much else that's going on. I rattled off the four or five different storylines this movie has going on when it really only needed to deal with two of them. And it actually deals with two of them quite effectively in the first hour. And then the rest of it is just – it's just Apatow has – just he wants to add one more and more and more.
Yeah.
And the movie just falls so flat and unfunny and unfocused. And I was just like, this should have been. He could make a trilogy out of Pete and Debbie, if he wants to. You know, he could have done that with all everything he threw out there in this movie. I don't know if he has an editor or not, Judd Apatow. Probably not at this stage of his career. He needs one.
Yeah,
he
no
needs
doubt.
Somebody to rein him in.
I mean, this movie really should have been. It would have been a much better movie, actually, had it been called "This Is Family" and not "This Is 40," because very little is paid to the actual.
No, it makes no difference. The fact that they're 40.
It plays into the plot zero. Like there's probably two off jokes that she's like, "Oh, I'm getting old. Oh, I'm gonna go to a club with Megan
Fox.
I'm
hiding my age. Oh,
yeah, I'm 39." But there's nothing else given to it. And you know, as much as I detested Albert Brooks' character in this, I mean, that's kind of just a testament to his performance. I thought everything they did there had a lot to do with it. And there was a lot of stuff in this movie that just made me mad to watch, but in a good way because it was showing. You know what actually happens, and I hope parents watch this, and I hope they realize the same. Travis, tell me if it was any different for you growing up. If you had talked to either one of your parents the way that their kids talk to them, Would you have still had a jaw that was intact? I wouldn't have.
No, I wouldn't have. Like, but like, I don't judge movies based on stuff like that. I agree with you. No, I would not have had a jaw left. I probably wouldn't be here today.
Right, but it's
but
just
I don't judge movies. I don't judge movies based on that because people parent differently.
But is because the other major problem I had. I'll just get this out of the way and it's all you. Other major problem I had is Judd Apatow is expecting us to feel for and identify with these people that are having money problems. And it's hard to do that when they're living in a McMansion and driving BMWs.
Their money problems are total bullshit.
And Lexuses, and they have $80,000 neon signs in their office building.
And they're running into the Philadelphia Flyers at random and all this other crap. And that part of it is total bullshit too. That they're so financially strapped. That they're so financially strapped that they could even lend out $80,000 to the father and not even really worry about it until it becomes an issue. And the only thing that's really the issue is that it keeps happening, not so much the money.
That's they're not getting back.
Yeah, so it is a little hard to identify with all that stuff. Their problems seem remarkably small and tiny and inconsequential. So that's another issue that you bring up that I totally agree with. To me, this movie is just – I don't want to call it a total fail. Like I said, I like the first half of it a lot, and he does find some really small and honest and true moments. I love that scene where they're together in the bedroom and they're talking about how they would kill one another. It seems like it'd be out of place for a movie like this, but it's not. Some people actually do talk that way. You know, you don't really mean it. But you think about it, and these are the things some people talk about, especially when you've been together as long as these two have.
There are
moments like that they find, and I think this movie is funnier when Apatow is speaking honestly like that. But when he's trying to come up with things to be funny in this movie, that's when this movie just it's miserable.
Yeah,
it's miserable. The whole Jason Segel's character, I didn't buy it for a second. Like,
there was no point in that even being in there. Like,
you know why it was there. It was there because Judd Apatow has to make Leslie Mann the sexiest person in every movie. And even in a movie where Megan Fox is in it, he still has to make Leslie Mann the sexiest person in the movie. I mean, it's just, the thing is, and I know he does it, and he probably means well, but he makes her the most shrewish harpy in every single movie she's in. Mm-hmm. Like, I mean, yeah, she's pretty. I get it. She's pretty for someone her age. I get it. But she's so goddamn vain in every movie too, and I don't think he's doing it intentionally, but that's the way it comes off.
Yeah,
and I don't like it at all.
Speaking of that, there's a couple things in that realm. Number one, I mean, everybody remembers when leave it to me to start talking about boobs. In the Change Up that she was in, where she had the CGI chesticles, as everybody was saying, it was kind of a scandal. I found that weird because they did say that was CGI, but what's the point of having CGI nudity if it looks exactly like the regular nudity, which was in this movie?
Wait, who was CGI nudity? What? Where? What?
Leslie Mann in the Change Up when she was.
I remember that. I don't know.
But here's that. I mean, that's just my little side joke to let everybody know.
On another
Leslie
side
Mann's
note, how hot did Megan Fox look in this movie, though? She did look really good.
Not at all. That's what
I thought she did.
Did it not look like to you, like, did she had some kind of plastic surgery done that it didn't become obvious what was weird, but something was weird? Like, her nose arched up a little bit weirdly or something? I don't know.
Nope. She looked fine.
I did.
I don't know if this was before she had the kid or not. I think it was after. But then again, I'm not sure. Either way, she looked pretty darn good to me. And I thought she was actually pretty good in this movie. This has been a strong year for her. She was also in Friends with Kids, which I think if you're going to watch a movie about, you know, growing older and staying in love, watch Friends with Kids. It's a better movie than this, a smarter movie than this, and a funnier movie than this with a better cast. Watch that movie instead over this. Go rent it. But Megan Fox is great in that movie, and I thought she was pretty good here. I mentioned I didn't like Jason Segel's appearance all that much. It's kind of pointless. And Charlene Yee, who was one of the few characters who comes back from Knocked Up, she's pointless too. So
she actually gives one of the most uncomfortably unfunny scenes in the whole movie.
That was so unfunny, and it goes on forever.
Yeah,
it's unfunny and long.
And that actually leads into one last thing I'll say about the movie and Judd Apatow in general is that it's kind of weird to think this since he's been so successful, but he really seems, in this movie, it really, really seems like he's desperately trying to not be, he's desperately trying to not lose his touch, but he's doing so by doing the same scenarios that worked previously, like Charlene Yee saying some crazy stuff, or, you know, if you notice, the funniest scene in Knocked Up, I thought was when they went to Vegas and took mushrooms in Cirque du Soleil, and they ended up, Paul Rudd's funniest scene was in the hotel room moving around chairs.
Right.
What are they doing in this movie? They go, they take some drugs and they go to a hotel room and they do shit that's really not funny at all.
No, it's not funny.
And, you know, Megan Fox, she did look funny to me for some reason, but I really like her in roles like this because, you know, prior to this, if just seeing her in Transformers, you'd think she was your stock hot chick that's on screen, but she actually has a lot of personality to her.
She's not a bad actress. She's actually pretty good. When she gets the chance to do something worthwhile, she does good work. Mm-hmm. I'd like to see her get, you know, some more. I'd like to see her get a better lead role than she got in Jennifer's Body. But she's solid in this movie as well. Overall, for me though, I did give this a 3 out of 5, mainly because of that first hour, which I thought was spectacular. But something about Apatow's got to figure out a new method. I don't know if he needs to. I know it's clear he doesn't want to go back to doing movies like The 40-Year-Old Virgin, but he's got to find a balance somewhere between that and movies like this. He's got to find a better balance. Something's not quite right for him. This has been two straight movies that have been very disappointing.
Yeah. And, you know, if he's always had success, whether it be his stuff's been good with Precinct Geeks and Undeclared all the way up through, his last couple movies. But I think maybe if he was basing all those movies on his life, maybe it's time to not do that so much because his life's not right.
I hope they never get a divorce because that's going to be an ugly movie.
Oh, Jesus.
Because you know he'll make a movie about it.
No doubt.
Clearly what he'll do, he'll make a movie about it.
Because it's the 50-year-old bachelor.
And he'll still put Leslie Mann in it, probably. Of course, he'll still probably put her in it.
Because that won't be awkward for all of us watching, even. I guess a 2 out of 5 for me. I kept expecting it to get funny around the corner, and it never did. But there was some potential there. I know a lot of people liked it, so it gets a 2 out of 5 for me.
Yeah. All right, speaking of awkward films, after Parental Guidance,
mm-hmm.
I came out of the theater – and I wasn't angry, but I did say something to the publicists who were waiting outside for our comments, as always, which is always my least favorite part of every screening.
Yeah.
I hate that part of it.
It's kind of awkward.
It is awkward, especially in situations like this. It's awkward. I always was jealous of our good friend Brandon Phibbs because, and I always told him this, I hated him, even though I loved him. I hated him. Because every time he came out of a screening, he had something really pithy and clever and insightful to say about a movie within seconds of it being over.
Yeah, it was almost like he had something practiced before each movie.
Right,
he was good at that.
Whereas me, I would come out and be like, I liked it. I didn't like it. You know, or I wouldn't even do that. I would just give him like the thumbs up or thumbs down or thumbs in the middle, which is probably the worst thing. They probably hate that to death. But, but I just don't – I need to think. You know, I can't just come out and say something.
Right.
And I hate when I come out and say, yeah, I liked it. And then I actually think about it, and I'm like, I didn't like it. And I send them a review that says something totally different than what I told them. But I always hated that. But I came out of this movie, and I told the publicist, and I think this is a quote, I hate you all for saving the worst movie of the year for the last screening of the year. I was like, why did you do that? Because I've already... I did my top 10 movies already for Examiner, and I put on there that the worst movie of the year was Alex Cross by Tyler Perry, because at that time it was the worst movie of the year until I saw Parental Guidance.
Mm-hmm.
Parental Guidance, first of all, it feels like it comes out of a time warp, straight out of 1987 or something. It is just the most ancient, decrepit piece of comedy crap I've seen in such a long time. It is ridiculous how old this movie is. Right from the word go, it's old. I mean, it's first of all, it's Billy Crystal, who I don't think has been funny since The Princess Bride. I don't think he's been funny since then. At least I can't think of a time when he's really funny since then.
Maybe City Slickers, but yeah, I would go back to 87.
We can argue about City Slickers, but it's been a long. Even if we did include City Slickers, that was like 1991.
Yeah.
So.
Well, Monsters Inc. If you count the animated Billy Crystal.
I don't count that. So he's already old, and he's doing that same goddamn shtick he's been doing for 30 years. Mm-hmm. Same damn thing. And then you got Bette Midler in there, who's always been a ham. And in this movie, she comes off like she just walked in from a vaudeville or something. I mean, she is just all over the place in this movie, over the top, when the scene does not require her to be over the top. It is just about as bad of a movie as it can be. And since most people might not know the plot of this one, so I'll actually run it down for in brief. But basically, Billy Crystal and Bette Midler play the other grandparents. You know, everybody has two sets of grandparents, and there's one that always gets more attention than the other one. Well, they're the ones that don't get any attention, and they want to change that. Marissa Tomei plays their daughter. She has three kids, one of whom is Bailey Madison, who I like. But she hasn't been in a good movie since Brothers, like 3 years ago. But anyway, Marissa Tomei and her husband, played by Tom Everett Scott, want to go away for a few days, but they're reluctant to leave their kids in the care of these grandparents who are old school, don't know how to talk to kids, don't know how to talk to anybody, and a little bit selfish. But they go away anyway, and of course, hilarity ensues, culture clash ensues. Disaster ensues as the grandparents try to impose their form of parenting on the kids. It's just a miserable movie overall. And if you want to know the scene that probably best exemplifies just how terrible this movie is, I'm just going to go ahead and spoil it because I don't think anybody's going to see it anyway. There's a scene where Billy Crystal is at a baseball game and he is arguing with the ref because there are no outs in this little league game. There are no outs, so he's upset. Billy Crystal's upset about that. So he's arguing, till one big kid comes up to him, hits him in the nuts with a baseball bat. Already unfunny, because nut humor is hardly funny anymore. Gets hit in the nuts with the bat, and then proceeds to projectile vomit all over this kid. It is a 1-2 punch of unfunniness, the likes of which I haven't seen in ages. This movie is brutal in every sense of the word. I give this a 1 out of 5. If I could find the original print of this movie, I would take a shit on it so that nobody else could ever see it again. That's my opinion of Parental Guidance. You can go ahead now. John? And John appears to have disappeared for a minute, which is fine. Because I don't know if he went mute just so I could go off on that little rant about Parental Guidance, but if he did, then I appreciate it. This movie is about as bad as a movie can be. There's nothing good about it whatsoever. I think the biggest surprise to me is that Marissa Tomei bothered to be in it. But then again, I look at her filmography and she's kind of hit or miss. As much as I love her, she's not totally against taking the occasional paycheck movie. Did you disappear just so I could rant, or did you just?
No, apparently my computer didn't want to listen to doesn't like Parental Guidance as much as we did. It just shut me off for a minute, but I'm here.
Okay, well I'm done with my rant on this movie. I gave it a 1 out of 5. I can't express how much I loathe this movie. But what's your opinion?
Yeah, I mean, this is one of those movies. I'm not far off from where you are. You pretty much said a lot of the things I wanted to say. But this is a perfect example of a movie, of how a movie can take wrong steps. Like, every time there's a fork in the road, they take the wrong way. And something that could have been good was horrible. I mean, it was way too in your face with the, oh, I'm old, and this is how we used to do it. You young whippersnappers are so doing it the wrong way. And there is a lot of stuff about today that certainly could be talked about and made fun of and make a good movie. Like the fact that, you know, there are actual sports teams that don't give the kids out so there's no losers. I think that's silly, and I think that would be, you know, a funny bit in a movie, but the way they do it is so wrong. It's like they had all the right ingredients but made a cake that tasted like ass.
Yeah.
And, you know, maybe some of those ingredients were stale, Reed, Bette Midler, and Billy Crystal, but, you know, it just – it was – There's something good there, but they never came anywhere near close to anything that could work it, and they wasted a really good premise for a movie. So
there's no insight about parenting in this movie. There's none of that. This movie's idea for solving any family problems is a good old game of kick the can, kick the bucket. Yeah. You know, and if you remember playing kick the bucket as a child, then maybe this movie's for you.
Yeah,
but nobody else.
What Bette Miller and Billy Crystal will probably do soon. That sounded a lot worse than I meant it to. legends.
The sad thing is, if people go to see this movie, there will be a sequel next year around the same time because clearly the goal is to try and make this sort of like a Meet the Parents style franchise. That's the point. Meet the Parents, not a bad movie, not a great movie either, but so many people went to see it that we got two or three more of them damn things.
Yeah.
So if you go to see this movie, expect to see more. Expect to see like that other grandparent, the other set of grandparents, expect to see them show up in the next movie.
Yeah.
So we have to nip this thing in the bud right now. Nobody go see this.
Yeah, we don't want more parental guidance. And I don't mean that as in more of this movie. I mean, the title of the movie will inevitably be more parental guidance. So just let's avoid that, folks, and go see anything else that's out there. It's obviously a paycheck from Marissa Tomei, and Billy Crystal and Bette Midler weren't feeling relevant.
It was so sad to watch her in this movie. It really was.
Yeah.
It sucked.
Yeah, whatever.
So we
really ended that review run on a down note, didn't we?
Yeah, well, we talked about a lot of movies today. We talked about four movies in an hour, so I'm happy about that. But considering we didn't really have a whole lot else to talk about today, we were able to give each movie their proper due. But we don't have the top 10 to do this week, so let's talk about what's on DVD next week.
This past week, I don't remember. We didn't do a show last week, but I guess you guys would already know what's out for DVD. Then next week, starting on the 4th – no, the 4th is this Friday. I'm sorry. I'm all mixed up. I'm actually stalling while I get my list up.
Movies are still coming out on Tuesday the 1st.
Do they really?
Yeah.
Oh, sweet. Okay, well, Cosmopolis is one of the movies that's coming out. I don't know if we ever even reviewed that on this show, but – I'm pretty sure it was horrible. I didn't see it.
I hated that movie with a passion. I don't even want to get into my reasons why, because I think we actually did talk about it. But I could not stand Cosmopolis. Such a pretentious, slow moving film. It's just nothing good about it. Nothing good to say about it except for the way it was shot by Cronenberg. That was about it. There was nothing else that I liked about that movie at all.
Yeah. There's the only other real movies that are coming out. And I don't even want to say real movies. One that I'm interested in seeing. I think we talked about it before. Was War of the Dead, which looks like Nazi zombies, which was the inevitable next point for zombies. Also, you know what's on video on demand right now that I've been wanting to watch is Iron Sky. Have you watched that yet?
I still haven't watched it now.
For anybody out there, it's the one where some Nazis escaped the invasion of Berlin in 1945 and escaped to the moon, where they've been creating their new civilization. So but War of the Dead is not about that. It's about zombies. And
there's a movie called Overtime coming out that stars Al Snow. If you know who Al Snow
from
is,
wrestling?
If you know from wrestling, wrestling's Al Snow, the guy who used to carry the head with him all the time. Al Snow is in a movie called Overtime. I've never heard of this thing. I don't know anybody else who's in it. But I'm curious to see it now. Just because he's on the cover. And it looks like there's a monster in there?
It's a monster. And he's holding a knife.
Girls,
it's got a gun on the bottom?
Yeah, some sort of gun blade or something. Guns, girls, aliens, zombies, cake. Okay.
I'm guessing he's like a chef, maybe?
like Under Siege? Like sleeping
maybe.
Goal.
I don't know. I can't. His shirt looks like it might be one of those white chef shirts, or it might just be a pinstripe collar shirt. I don't know.
Pretty shitty week of movies. All the good movies probably came out the week before because they wanted you to buy them for Christmas. So now there's like nothing left.
Being Human season 2. If anybody, the U.S. version. If anybody's fans of that comes out.
Never seen it.
What's that?
Never seen it. Is it good?
I watched a couple. It was good from what I watched. My wife watches a lot. The first season, she loves it. It's Sam Witwer, who most famously for most people probably is he played Starkiller in The Force Unleashed, Star Wars video game. But he was also on Smallville, and then nobody else in the movie would really know. One of the Ashmores, I think, possibly. I don't know. But the one other movie that it does coming out that looks interesting, I kind of just want to see it for the tagline. The tagline is Twilight meets Tarantino. It's called The Thompsons. It's got a bunch of really it's got one guy who's got a bowl cut, and he's looking off with blood down his mouth like a vampire, and then a chick in the back who looks like she's having way too much fun, and then a guy that's just confused to be there on the front. So that's coming out soon. So there you go.
All right. That was awesome.
It's coming out on the 8th, I'll tell you that.
Yeah, well, let's see. What else? Not much else DVD, Blu-ray DVD-wise. Little Birds comes out. That has Juno Temple in it. Who I love Juno Temple. So I kind of want to see that. I think we have the trailer up on the site, too.
The best part of Killer Joe. Only part that you can watch.
I still haven't seen it. It's on demand here, and I haven't ordered it yet. But I do want to watch that, just because I'm tired of hearing everybody else talk about how great it was. So
hear me say that.
Trailers that came out this week. It was a slow week for news, so there wasn't a whole lot. But we got new trailers for The Place Beyond the Pines. That's the movie with Ryan Gosling and Bradley Cooper from Derek C. in France, the guy who did Blue Valentine last year. First trailer for Aftershock, which stars Eli Roth and Selena Gomez. It's a Chilean horror film. Looks kind of terrible, actually. Trailer for Scary Movie 5, the first one of those came out. It looks as miserable as you probably think it does.
Yeah.
It looks really unfunny. Really
painfully
unfunny.
Isn't Lohan in this one?
And she is in it. Charlie Sheen is in it. Ashley Tisdale is the main character now because there's no Anna Faris.
Well, there you go. That's all you
need to hear. Pretty bad. The trailer that I was most interested in this week, sadly, was the Marine 3 Homefront from WWE Studios, of course. And this one stars Mike the Miz Mizanin, who most people remember from The Real World. It looks like the Marine movie. That's what it looks like. If you know what the first two look like, then you know what this one looks like. Except just put the Miz in the place there, except for John Cena. Or Ted DiBiase. So, So that's out there. It's interesting. I'll at least give it that. And a trailer that came out. You like the Marine?
Yeah.
Okay.
I like the Marine.
It's not terrible. It's just
two John Cena ones. I mean, they were serviceable action movies. Nothing to write home. I mean, they're your standard Saturday afternoon TBS action.
Very standard. Very standard. If you wouldn't look up stock action movie, the Marine is right there next to it in the definition. It's just a stock action movie, lots of explosions, lots of slow motion jumping away from explosions.
Yeah.
I think me and my friends commented, try to count how many times John Cena did that actually in the first movie.
Yeah, got away from explosions.
It's all he did was slow motion jump from explosions. And then the sequel was just a dreadful mess with Ted DiBiase as the star. That was back when Vince McMahon was trying to turn him into a big star.
Into a million-dollar man.
into a million-dollar man, yeah, and that failed miserably, actually. Not only did it instantly destroy his career as an actor, but it kind of destroyed him as a wrestler, too. He sucks ass now.
But that's
and I'm afraid they're actually doing that to The Miz, because they're trying to turn The Miz into a Hollywood star now, too. And you can see in the way they treat his character on Monday and Thursday nights, on Monday and Friday nights now, he's become like this good guy. He's a face. So now he's all nice and shit, and he is just as boring a character as he could be now. He used to be kind of edgy and cool. Now he just sucks. But so I'm afraid they're ruining him, too. but they keep trying to find that next Rock, that next Dwayne Johnson, you know?
Yeah, but lightning in a bottle, man. You're not going to find him.
Yeah.
Even Steve Austin, who was The Rock's, the only person on his level during that Attitude era of wrestling – Steve Austin he translated better than most to action movies because he's got better personality. But
right.
The Rock is he was born a Hollywood star. I mean, he's born movie star. There's some people who are just like that.
Yeah, there's few people that are quite as charismatic as The Rock is. And you have to remember when he first came out there, he was terrible. He was a terrible wrestler when he first came out there. He was never a great in-ring performer. It was always just charisma. And Vince McMahon, of course, tried to stifle that charisma with the terrible opening gimmick he had as a wrestler. But
The Nation of Domination?
It's when he joined the Nation of Domination that he blossomed.
Yeah.
It was before then that he was just awful. But what works for these for wrestlers like Stone Cold Steve Austin and The Rock, and I guess to an extent Triple H, who also could have been a decent actor if he wanted to be, but I don't think he really did. What works for them is letting them
career performances in Blade Trinity.
I actually liked him in Blade Trinity.
He was good. I did like him.
In that movie. He didn't do much else after that. He did a movie like a year or two ago that was just horrible. But what works with is for those kinds of stars is letting them be themselves, and that's the character they become. That's kind of what The Rock did. He just kind of became himself. Austin did that. If you remembered him in WCW where he was allowed to do that, he was a lot like he is now, except he had long blonde hair. But The Miz, this is not The Miz being The Miz. The Miz being The Miz was the guy he was a year or two ago when he was a jerk. Because he was a jerk on The Real World, if you ever watched him on the damn show.
He was a jerk.
And that was him just being himself. He was a fucking asshole. So why trying to make him a nice guy now? It doesn't make any sense. But anyway, so that trailer's out. And a trailer that came out today that I thought looked excellent, which is coincidentally another WWE Studios co-production, and it's Dead Man Down, which stars Colin Farrell and Noomi Rapace. From The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, and it's directed by Niels Arden Oplev, who is the director of the Swedish The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo movie. So they're reunited for this. And this one looks fantastic. Moody, atmospheric crime thriller. Besides those two, it also stars Dominic Cooper and Isabelle Huppert, who's a fantastic actress, one of my favorites. If you haven't seen that trailer, like I said, it only came out this morning. Check that out. It looks excellent.
I actually haven't seen that trailer yet, but I've really noticed it seems like WWE Films is starting to really branch out. This is like the second
movie
that there's not a wrestler in the top billing. So
yeah.
It'd be interesting. I mean, they certainly have the resources, and that's really all you need. Resources and people that know what they're doing. So it sounds like they got some people that know what they're doing.
This is the smart way to do it. I mean, the Film District is distributing it. So this is WWE Studios kind of, you know, getting into it alongside them. But it's a good way to get your foot in the door into bigger Hollywood productions. I like the move. It's a smart move. The movie looks great. Has a fantastic cast, like I mentioned. So good stuff. I mean, good stuff.
No doubt. Yeah, the only thing I really wanted to talk about was something that we just had a quick thing on there, and that's Elijah Wood in the new movie Maniac that's coming out. We got a couple minutes from the movie on there, and I think you actually touched on in your post. My main thing is that I love seeing Elijah Wood in this type of role ever since I saw Sin City, because I mean we always know Elijah Wood as the good guy, the little Frodo type, or even in something like The Faculty, but he has a look that. It can certainly be, a little sweet, good guy, but it can also be fucking psychotic, crazy mass killer murderer. And he does it very well. You mentioned in your post about the first-person perspective of the killer, and that really brought me back watching that little bit because all I could think of was, were you a fan of the movie Brain Scan back in the day?
Somewhat.
That's a movie that I would like to see redone because it that would make a lot more
sense.
I'm
sure it will be.
Now.
I'm sure it will be. It'll work.
Oh, yeah, it will be at some point. But basically, he plays a video game and he got blacked out, and then there's real murders being committed. Did he commit them or not? Check out Brain Scan if you haven't seen it already. But the picture you have up here of Elijah Wood, you don't even need to watch the first 6 minutes. You just need to see that picture to know. He can put that ice-cold killer look in his eyes very easily. I this isn't going to be an Oscar winner, obviously, but I'm actually looking forward to it now that I see the footage.
The other thing I wanted to talk about was our most popular post from the last week, other than our top fives, which all did excellent, I might add. If you haven't checked out everybody's top fives for the year, they were up all last week, and you can still find them on the site now. They're all excellent. Another thing that came out this weekend that was really popular was Quentin Tarantino talking about his next project that he may do, or at least an upcoming project, which is going to get people riled up already, and it already has because I've gotten the messages on Twitter from people complaining. But he's talking about doing what would essentially be the final chapter of his kind of loose-knit revenge trilogy And it'd be a film called Killer Crow. And it would follow African-American soldiers during World War II after Normandy. Basically, it would use stuff that he left out of Inglourious Basterds, because that was supposed to be a bigger movie than it was. But he says, just to quote him a little bit, he says, let's see, it would follow the black troops who go on an Apache warpath, and kill a bunch of white soldiers and white officers on a military base, and are just making a warpath to Switzerland. If you were upset by Django Unchained, chances are you will be upset about Killer Crow.
Yes. Just
based off that, you're probably going to be upset by it. Now, he doesn't say this is going to be his next film. I still think he's going to do that gangster film he's been talking about for like 10 years. I still think he'll do that next. But clearly, he has an idea in his head on how he wants to wrap up this kind of historical wish fulfillment trilogy he's made here. What's your opinion on this? Just hearing this, just that little bit.
I've learned to reserve a judgment and opinion on Tarantino until I actually see the finished product. But that being said, it does bother me a little bit. It doesn't bother me. That's not what I should be saying. But it makes me worry a little bit that he's going for, like, you know, the not race war thing, but, you know, it's you know, always a revenge between races or something like that type deal. I like it better when he's got everybody working together, like there is no color around, like Samuel Jackson and John Travolta in Pulp Fiction. I, you know, because race was never an issue with those two guys. Like, you know, it never came. Didn't imagine. And, you know, I hate to be the bearer of news, people, but that's the only way we get past racism is by not letting any race issues exist. And the way that Samuel Jackson and John Travolta were in Pulp Fiction is what I'd like to always see. I don't like to see him putting the whole crutch of the movie on race relations type stuff. But at the same time, I don't know how he's going to present it. So I can't really say anything more. I mean, I can see where it could go wrong, or I could see where it could go very right.
Yeah. I mean, but if this really is sort of a trilogy that he's kind of dreamed up, then I would expect it to follow sort of the same kind of, you know, aesthetic as the other ones. I would expect it to have some of the same racial dynamics as the other movies do. So I understand that, but I am anxious to see him do other things now. So, I mean, I think it's good that he might be taking a break in between and do something else before this.
You know, that's kind of short-sighted, though. I will say, because, you know, that's how visual human beings are, and that's why we have so many problems in this area, is that, I mean, really, Inglourious Basterds was a movie about race relations as well. You know, Jews and Germans, that's the same difference. Stupid like most people, and I take things for the visual cue. But so I see where it all goes. But I got to see how he presents everything.
Well, we actually got a phone call here. I'm going to see who this is. We only got a couple minutes left in the show, but I'm going to see who this is. Hold on a second.
All right.
Who's this?
Hey, my name's John, and I'm calling from deep southern Indiana to talk about Django Unchained.
Hey, John, how you doing?
How you doing, John? We only got a minute or two left on the show here, so what do you have to say?
Well, I want you guys to check out my website at CaucasianPersuasion.com, where we have written some articles on this movie. And obviously the intent of this movie is to have young black people watch it, young and uninformed criminal black people who are going to go out there and imitate these crimes.
And we'll talk to you later, buddy.
Yeah, probably not.
See ya.
And that's the fun of having people call in.
Man,
that was funny. That was fun. I had a lot of fun with that for the 10 seconds we let him on. But, you know, if we actually had more time on the show, I would have let him go on with that spiel, because I like comments like that, even though I know he's wrong and he's probably being an idiot. I would have let him go on with it for a minute, but we don't have enough time for that today, unfortunately.
Well, see, the thing is, I get too angry at that kind of ignorance, and I can't reach through the microphone and grab
it. As soon as he said Caucasian Persuasion, you knew where he was going. As soon as he said what the name of the website was, you knew where he was going. But I try not to get upset over stuff like this. I try to laugh it off. And that's what I would have had to do here. But anyway, where were we? We were talking about Django Unchained. And I think he's going to be taking a little bit of a break in between and doing something different between this. Now, he doesn't say that specifically, but I'm anxious to see him do other things too. We'll see what happens. We only got 5 minutes left on the show here. So let's talk about what we got coming up for tomorrow. Tomorrow is our year end show. Like I said, we'll have Nell Minow on, the Movie Mom, and somebody else. I haven't figured out who we're going to ask to be to join us here. I kind of want to bring in another female. I know we could bring in Julian, who's the other Punch Drunk critic, but I kind of want another female. So I'll shoot you an email after the show, and we'll talk about that.
But I mean, regardless of who we'll have on, we're going to have some great stuff. We'll have our top of the year movies, top three, I think we're each doing, and then we're going to have some certain categories to spice up a little bit. I really like what you sent over. I don't know if you want to keep that a surprise or not, but you know, everybody does, you know, top five of the year, oh, bottom one of the year, yeah. But we're going to bring some other categories into it, really kind of spice things up a bit, and let you guys know. On our final full show of the year, and though we will be bringing you Punch Drunk Critics on, you know, we haven't figured out yet what we're gonna do. Maybe it's monthly, maybe it's specials only, but it'll be our last full show in regular schedule season. So make sure you tune in for that, because you guys stuck with us this long, and you need to stick with us tomorrow too as well.
You know what? I actually went to CaucasianPersuasion.com, and it's an actual site with actual stupid people on there saying stupid things.
Yeah.
So go figure.
I was getting ready to hang up on the douchebag while he was talking, because I couldn't figure out how to spell Caucasian. But I pulled it up. It's idiots. I mean, the thing is, here's the worst thing about people like that, and here's why I hung up on him so quick. It's not because I'm scared that the dude's going to say something smarter than we are, because there's a zippy chance in hell that's going to happen. It's the fact that, number one, I could talk all day with all the solid evidence in the world that guy has less brains than dog shit, and it would not change his – stupid people don't change.
No, it doesn't matter.
Runs the risk of people going to this website, and I just don't want to spread
giving
that
him the attention he wants. That's what we don't want to do. People like that don't deserve to get the attention they want. It's like when the media like mentions the name of some asshole serial killer. That's what they want. They want you to say their name. Don't say their names. You know. Yeah. And I agree with you. It's not worth it to give these people the attention they deserve. Anyway,
Dick Face, for making one of our last shows have me be angry at the end now.
I love that moment, though. I think you and I were hitting the button at the same time to drop him off. So, but anyway, let's wrap this bad boy up.
Yes, let's get out of here. We are the Punch Drunk Critics. You can find us every day at punchdrunkcritics.com. You guys need to sign up on Facebook, become fans of Punch Drunk Critics on our Google group on the site. We are always doing giveaways. Now, we've been a little slow last week on them, but it's been Christmas. You're not going to screeners during that time anyway. Duh.
We got a couple big screenings coming up. Zero Dark Thirty screening is going up probably either tonight or tomorrow.
Gangster Squad.
Yes, and then Gangster Squad also. So two big screenings coming up that we'll be putting up on the set.
And we want to hook you guys up with that, so make sure you sign up there. Don't forget to pick up all those DVDs you heard about. Any movies, any kind of movie-related situation at the Punch Drunk Critics Superstore, just go to punchdrunkcritics.com. Click on Punch Drunk Critics Shop at Punch Drunk Critics, the upper right-hand corner. I am sick, guys. I'm trying to get through it, but my brain's a little cloudy. Sorry.
You sounded fine. I didn't even notice you were sick, to be honest. So.
If you guys have any questions, comments, or suggestions, anything you want to see in the future from us, just go to punchdrunkcritics@gmail.com and send us a note. Let us know about it. And I think that's about all we got. So thanks
pretty much.
I
want to say real fast before we get out of here, thank you to all of you who have been buying from the site over the holiday season. That always happens, and I love it. Thank you very much. I know John appreciates it as well. Mm-hmm. My new show, Cinema Royale, starts in a week. And then, you know, like I said, like we've talked about before about this show, we'll keep it going somehow. And if I can find a way in my schedule and in John's schedule to do this on a weekly basis still, we're going to figure out a way to do it. So we're going to work on that part of it. But Punch Drunk Critics Live isn't going anywhere. So
yeah, the important thing is, no, neither one of us is going anywhere. We'll still be accessible around. Nothing is ending. We're just switching some stuff up, keeping it lively. So remember that, and
Maybe change the name. Well, we'll talk about that later.
You want to change it to Caucasian Persuasion?
Maybe. We might get more viewers.
We should all those names and just to fuck with that guy.
We'll get that guy. He'll listen.
Yeah. Lord. All right.
Later.
We'll see you guys later. We're out.
We came, we saw, we kicked its ass. That's it, man. Game over, man. It's game over.
I'm not great at farewell, so that'll do, Pig.
That's the worst goodbye I've ever heard. And you stole it from a movie.